My name is Jessica Yates with the International Security Program here at CSIS. Today is the 20th of December, 2007, and I'll be interviewing Dr. Richard Wagner of the Los Alamos and Lawrence Livermore National Laboratories. This is the first of a series of interviews taking place for the PONY project evaluating U.S.-UK nuclear cooperation as we approach the 50th anniversary of the Mutual Defense Agreement. Dr. Wagner, if you could begin by briefly describing your career to date, both in and out of government.
I started my professional career at the Lawrence Livermore National Laboratory in nuclear weapon design during the 70s, led a major part of the nuclear weapon design and development program and the underground testing program, and was the deputy director of the laboratory in the late 70s. Left Livermore in 1981 to come to Washington to be the assistant to the Secretary of Defense for Atomic Energy, which was the keeper of the technical side of the Mutual Defense Agreement at the time and before and after. I left the Pentagon in 1986, went to work for a defense contractor, the Command Corporation, for 10 years, joined Los Alamos in 1996, but always here in D.C., so I've never lived in Los Alamos. Retired from Los Alamos a couple of years ago, but continue to work part-time, and I spend most of my time on advisory committees, the Defense Science Board, the STRATCOM Strategic Advisory Group. I chair the Defense Intelligence Agency's Advisory Board, the Threat Reduction Advisory Committee for OSD, things like that. So that's me.
Okay.
Before I ask you more specific questions about what I gather to be your involvement in the MDA, can you tell me anything about the circumstances, or can you describe what you perceive to be your role in the MDA, sort of generically, or both in and out of government?
When I was at Livermore in the early and mid-70s, I was what you might call a technical participant. I was leading a part of the weapon program, and a number of people had close technical working relationships with a number of people at what was then called AWRE, the Atomic Weapons Research Establishment, now AWE. And I suspect that during those years, I went to the UK a couple of times and was in meetings at Livermore probably a dozen times with UK folks, AWRE folks. Then when I came to the Pentagon, I was actively involved both with the Mutual Defense Agreement management itself. Some part of that was dealing with the expansion of the scope of the what could be discussed in the relationship, some. And part of it was an activity that was not expressly a part of the agreement, but which was strongly influenced by it, and that had to do with dealing with deterrence in NATO writ broadly. My responsibilities in the Pentagon in those days had to do with not only design and procurement of weapons, but their operations around the world, how we operated with the weapons. And that was particularly important in Europe. The safety and security of the weapons under what then was the rather substantial terrorist threat in Europe in the early 80s was important, and that impinged on the question of the survivability of deployed tactical U.S. weapons in Europe, which, as the doctrine went, might be attacked in a Warsaw Pact attack on Europe first. And our job was to assure that they would survive attacks by the Warsaw Pact. And there was a delicate relationship between the survivability of the weapons, which might be achieved by dispersing them, and the security and safety of the weapons, which would be best achieved by never taking them out of their garrison sites. So managing that tension was an important part of it. That was not expressly a part of the mutual defense agreement with the UK, but I chaired a committee called the Senior Level Weapon Protection Group that had UK reps on it, along with the other NATO nations. And my relationships with the UK folks in that part of my job, I found to merge almost seamlessly with my relationship with UK folks in the work that was expressly part of the technical exchanges that were expressly part of the MDA. Another thing that was going on in those years was the UK was beginning to work toward, maybe we're well along in working toward their version of the Trident system. And that was a major part of the technical interchanges that we had. After I left government, I had almost nothing to do with the mutual relationship for up until now. I don't think I've been to AWE since I left government in 86.
Well, you were in graduate school, I think, when the MDA was signed in 1958. But based on either your experience in the early years or knowledge that you have about the treaty, can you tell me anything about the circumstances that surrounded the formation of the treaty or the sort of organization of the technical exchanges at the earlier stages?
Clearly, the beginning of the relationship extended back before World War II, when British scientists were active in the development of the understanding of nuclear physics. That led to the intimate incorporation of British scientists in the Manhattan Project. That was undermined later after the war by the revelations of various security leaks. While I don't remember it in detail, my sense is that there was not a complete hiatus, but a kind of a downturn in the nuclear weapon relationship for a while. That was then when the relationship was formalized in 1958. My memory of reading the history is that. It was expressly to try to reinvigorate the relationship, and then my more personal memory is that in the early 1970s, the scope of what could be discussed about nuclear weapon design and technology was broadened substantially. And when I began to talk with UK scientists and engineers in the 1972-73 timeframe, the expansion of the scope was on the steep part of the curve, and there was lots that was being said that hadn't been able to be said before. I remember one particular thing from the early 70s. One of the important ancillary technologies about nuclear weapons is the ability to do flash radiographs, take very short time X-ray snapshots of the implosion of nuclear weapon primaries without fissile material, something that is a key design tool in both, well, everywhere that anyone is working on nuclear weapons. And at Livermore, I was responsible for the primary design program in the early and mid-70s, and we were in the process of developing a new flash X-ray machine for doing these radiographs. And these machines are not like your doctor's office X-ray machines. They're the size of a building, and make an extremely intense, extremely short pulse of X-rays to penetrate the imploding assembly and register on a screen of some kind, which is then recovered and analyzed. And the UK had a scientist named Charlie Martin. I think he was probably an electrical engineer who had some very innovative ideas about how to build these flash X-ray machines. And we had many, many meetings with Charlie and others from AWRE in the 1972-3-4 period. And it was largely Charlie's ideas that led to, in some ways, a resurgence of electron accelerator technology in the U.S. And you accelerate the electrons in order to create the flash X-ray, the flash of X-rays, which led pretty directly to much bigger machines in the 80s and 90s that were built at both Livermore and Los Alamos, and probably the development of that technology could be traced to the recent development at Los Alamos of the DART, dual-axis hydroradiography technology, DAHRT, I think it is. So Charlie Martin at AWRE really got us off headed down the right line. We didn't do things exactly the way Charlie suggested, but his ideas influenced our thinking a lot. Another that technology wasn't associated so much directly with design itself, but with the tools that both countries used for evaluating nuclear weapon designs. But a major part of the exchange in the 70s had to do with talking about the way nuclear weapons worked, the views on the computer models of the implosions and explosions. All nations with nuclear weapons use computer models of the physics involved in the implosions and explosions to help design weapons. The U.S. was, I think I would say, far ahead of the U.K., probably of everyone else in the world at the time, in the size of computers that were used, and therefore the size of the computer codes and models that could be used, and therefore the rigor of the physics that could be captured in the models. We were sharing with UK folks, as they brought their computer capabilities along, the techniques for writing these big computer codes that would capture the physics. There are all kinds of ways you can do that wrong, and we were sharing some of those ways with the Brits. A thing that I remember that sort of cross-cuts all of these kind of particular parts of the exchanges is that there were always, and are still always, sort of knotty, difficult problems in nuclear weapon design. And to the extent that we could talk about them with our UK counterparts, and that extent was expanding at the time, we time and again found that our British counterparts would have a, they didn't have quite the tools that we had to work on these non-difficult problems. They didn't have the computer codes. They didn't really have the hydrodynamic testing capabilities, Charlie Martin's knowledge notwithstanding. But they would think deeply about the physics and the science and just had a good physical intuition for the way hydrodynamics caused fission. And they would have an interesting and often more insightful view on some of these difficult problems than we had with our bigger computers and more extensive experimental facilities. So we learned a lot. We always would kind of keep track in a sort of informal way. I mean, you know, who was benefiting more from this exchange? And I always felt that that was not a particularly fruitful path to go, but in part because the nature of the benefit was different on the two sides. I think much of, if you think of sort of technology transfer, there was probably more flow from the U.S. to the U.K., but if you think of insight transfer, it was at least equal. And maybe the flow was more from them to us in those days. Would you like me to go on with the 80s? Because that's about all I can remember.
No, I'll ask more tailored questions. I think.
Okay.
Said, you're in a pretty unique position, I think, because you've had extensive hands-on experience both in the policy realm and the scientific realm of nuclear issues, and I think that gives you a really important perspective on the spectrum of bilateral cooperation, from sort of creating the institutional framework for that cooperation to actually doing it, the technical exchanges and, you know, overseeing it, the substance of the cooperation being carried out. So I'd kind of like to divide the questions between the policy element and then the scientific element, and then get a kind of an understanding of the policy science interface as you experienced it, which I think is, you know, obviously a fascinating subject in this context. So beginning with, I guess, some more policy questions, as Weinberger's assistant, you know, you're the chair of the military liaison committee to the DOE. Is that the same thing as the assistant? Are those different titles for the same position?
It was two hats that were almost indistinguishable.
Okay, right. So in that, I guess you kind of answered this already, but in that capacity, how did you deal with the MDA directly beyond the NATO sharing?
Yeah, to be honest with you, I don't remember the quite the formalisms of the maybe the formal management or the legislative basis. I mean, I could probably resurrect that, and you may know more about it than I do. Of the legislative basis, but the actual process by the general trend in the policy dimension was to continually expand the scope of what could be talked about, and at the time. And the way it would work would be the technical people on both sides would propose that the scope be expanded in some particular way. That would be reviewed for policy ramifications. Sometimes the policy dimensions would not conduce toward the full realization of the expansion that the technical folks wanted, but generally it did. And I think that there's a the policy view of this particular arrangement went much broader than just the MDA itself. I mean, we've all probably Winston Churchill and Franklin Roosevelt used the term, and it may have preceded them, you know, a special relationship. And there was the sense that we and the United Kingdom were sort of in this Cold War thing together, as we had been in the World War II together. And that that probably generally kind of undocumented and unformalized, but still very operative mindset in the policy realm underlay everything that had to do with the specifics of the formal agreement of the formal arrangements for the Mutual Defense Agreement. But I think also there was a kind of unvoiced, implicit understanding that there was kind of a quid pro quo, that probably the net benefit of the technical interchanges accrued to the UK side, and the US would hope that the UK would support US policy desires broadly writ in deterrence policy as a whole with regard to the, you know, Cold War policy. It extended to such things as the role of the UK deterrent force itself in the underlying deterrence relationship of the Cold War between the Warsaw Pact and the free world. In some sense the goodwill, which was always there, in the technical interchange. I mean, there was never anything but a sense of really common purpose. I think that probably carried over to support the kind of goodwill with which the much larger scale deterrence issues were approached. Go ahead.
I'm just going to lose sight of this.
You mentioned earlier discussing the policy component that in most instances policymakers would adapt to the demands of the technical community and expand the scope of cooperation. But what were their concerns? What held them back from kind of fully realizing the demands of the technical community? What did they feel was a problem?
One of the concerns was security. I don't remember particulars, but my sense was that our counterintelligence people might have had some concerns about the way the UK labs might protect information. one of the ways in which that concern was reflected was in the one of the firm boundaries at the time was that we could exchange fairly freely information about a lot of aspects of the physics and the engineering of nuclear weapons, but specific U.S. nuclear weapon designs, the blueprints, so to speak, with perhaps one or two small exceptions, were barred from the exchange. The idea being that if there were, let's say, exploitable vulnerabilities in the U.S. designs, that we simply didn't want to risk their being compromised. But I think really that was probably the major consideration that prevented truly complete interchange.
This is kind of bleeding into my questions I was going to ask you about science, but I think it's really relevant. As a scientist and as you've worked in the laboratories, how viable of a concern is the national security issue? When you were there, was it ever kind of on your mind that, you know, are these people going to take our secrets and turn on us?
I don't think the concern was ever that they would turn on us, but that some third party like the Russians would penetrate their system and learn things that the Russians could use in some way against us in a variety of ways, not just particular vulnerabilities of our weapons, but to help, let's say, the Soviets understand better just the general technological directions we were heading, and which they might be able to use to guide their own programs, which, of course, had been the path. I mean, the first Soviet nuclear test was based on the Los Alamos design, and so that was there was always that concern. But I tended to leave the judgments about the security that the UK lab had to the security experts. They expressed some concerns. I probed the basis for their concerns to some extent, but fundamentally left it to them. And it wasn't a serious inhibition. I mean, it sort of slowed the expansion of the scope. It did. I doubt that there was ever a time when it was a major inhibition to expanding the scope.
I'm not sure how relevant these particular amendments were, but in 1979, the MDA was amended, which was right before you entered the administration. Was that amendment relevant to that?
You're going to have to remind me.
Frequently mentioned the scope. Right. Actually, I kind of have this huge, all this literature on that.
Yeah.
It's kind of over my head exactly what the amendment did, and I don't even know if it's that relevant. But you mentioned the expansion of the cooperation in the 70s, and I'm not sure if the amendment in 79 was a component to that expansion. Likewise, there was an amendment in 84. I think that it might have passed the United States that year or the year after to the MDA itself, and whether those amendments in your mind were a component to that expansion or whether whether that had any impact on the cooperation.
One of the things that was on the table during the 80s when I was in the Pentagon was we were putting in place in our weapons a sort of stockpile-wide upgrade of safety features and security features. And it was in our interest also for UK weapons to be safe and secure. And I believe that we were working the expansion of the scope to handle to include more maybe a broader scope on safety and security measures. Safety in particular, security, use control features were extremely closely held and still are, with special access categories and so forth. And I think we did not share much there with the UK. But safety features, in particular, insensitive high explosive, which was just beginning to be incorporated in our stockpile, were things that we felt was probably important for the UK to know about, and they thought so too. That probably was the one of the features that was addressed in a 1984 revision. But frankly, I don't remember. I do remember. My main memory is of a sort of a continual expansion. Now the expansion undoubtedly was punctuated by revisions of the agreement. But the general sense, it was a relatively continual expansion. Sort of continual because when the agreement would get modified, it would take some years to really exploit that modification. And that was so the scope of the exchanges could be broadened rapidly, but in fact, just in terms of practicality, took a while to broaden.
A sort of critical juncture in the special relationship during your time in the government was the crisis of the Falklands Islands, and, you know, the relationship initially suffered because Reagan was kind of Reagan's neutrality, and then Weinberger agreed to send missiles and other military equipment to help the British, and that, you know, significantly bolstered the relationship. Obviously, we didn't send nuclear weapons, or this didn't probably explicitly invoke the MDA, but do you think that during that crisis, do you think that the MDA was component to it, or just, you spoke a little bit earlier about the broader assistance or military assistance. Yeah. Can you comment on the interplay between that?
I don't remember any specific relationship between the MDA and the Falklands relationship, the relationship around the Falklands. I would suspect that it played some small role in the sense of just sort of the general appreciation of sharing security issues, but I don't remember any particular thing to it.
Sort of a follow-up is, but you definitely did you talked quite a bit about the broad cooperation under the special relationship that it's benefited the United States in ways outside of particularly nuclear cooperation because they, you know, join on to United States efforts in other areas. Do you think that that can explain things like Tony Blair's support for the war despite the public outcry? Do you think that there's a direct, at all, if at all, or any relationship between this treaty and those, that sort of cooperation?
I doubt that there. I think most of those kinds of what I would call very high-level, top-level relationships are simply guided more by the quote, historic special relationship between the UK and the US than by the specifics of of this.
So this is probably a cause of that, not the...
Yeah,
okay,
yeah.
That makes sense.
Next set of questions I want to ask are about your time as a scientist, more specifically. You are involved in nuclear R&D efforts, which is obviously the central focus of this treaty, so you're right at the center of the storm. You mentioned this kind of quite a bit, but would you say that there are any projects or any components to our nuclear program now that couldn't exist without UK cooperation?
I don't think there's anything that couldn't exist at all, but there are things that wouldn't be that we wouldn't be doing as well as we are today without the UK relationship. I mentioned flash radiography earlier. I think that's certainly one aspect of it. I don't think of specific things because the relationship in many ways was so close that practically everything was caught up in it.
Right.
And it was almost as if your question could well have been, would we have been less far along today if our own program had been without 5 or 10% of its best technical people? And the answer is, of course, it would not be as far along today without that. And that's kind of the way it was.
Would you then characterize the UK contribution as roughly 5 to 10%?
I would not want to put a number.
Okay,
on it.
Great. Fair. That's totally fair. Besides Charlie, I forget his last name. Charlie Martin. Are there any other UK scientists or British counterparts that you remember working with?
Bill Parsons was here in the embassy for many years. Before I came to Washington, I'm quite sure I had known Bill when I was at Livermore, and he was still here for, I think, some years after I left the Pentagon. Bill was a unique resource to both nations, not only on the specifics of the weapon interchanges, but simply on the kind of everything that was really going on in the UK, and I'm sure he played the same role for his UK counterparts, sort of everything that's going on in the US. He was absolutely indispensable. When I was in the Pentagon, my counterparts on the UK side seems to me that their titles were something like the chief scientist of the MOD, which had a, I mean, there was a slightly different relationship between their position in the in their defense establishment and my position in our defense establishment. But the two folks that were my counterparts, almost counterparts, were Colin Fielding at the beginning, and then Ron Mason. Ron was knighted, so he was Sir Ronald while he was still in the job, and Colin was knighted later after he had left this particular part of the program. But they were wonderful people to work with, insightful, sort of flamboyant, Fielding in a sort of a quietly flamboyant way, and Ron Mason in a very overtly flamboyant way, entertaining people as well as valued colleagues. I believe that because of the slightly different position that they had in the UK defense establishment, interchange may have benefited from a slightly broader look into the everything that was going on technologically in the UK Ministry of Defense. My position was more narrowly nuclear, although not entirely, and I probably wasn't in a position to bring quite as much to the table in terms of breadth as Colin and Ron were.
Did you witness the relationship evolve over time?
With the exception of the expansion of the scope, which certainly evolved, I'm not particularly struck by any change sort of in the flavor of the relationship. I mean, the flavor was always good, there might have been small ups and downs, but frankly, I don't remember them.
I'm interested to hear you describe them as flamboyant or less flamboyant. I guess I'm kind of interested in just the parts, the details that won't be revealed in the history book about the MDA and kind of the dinners you had or the, you know, kind of conversations or how important that personalities are getting along and had you not gotten along or were there huge cultural differences, whether this cooperation would have been possible. If you can comment on any anecdotal experience.
Well, I remember one evening at Ron Mason's home outside London in Kent, Ron and I played billiards where the stakes were the whole U.S. defense budget. So if Ron won, he would get to control for a year the U.S. defense budget, and if I won, I would get to control the U.K. defense budget. And I won, but I don't remember benefiting an awful lot from controlling the U.K. defense budget. I remember another thing about the... It was not probably particular to treaty, the technical interchange program, but in the NATO committee, the senior level weapon protection group that I chaired most of the time I was in the Pentagon, you know, the British are so wonderful. I mean, it's their language, it's not ours, and they're so good with it.
Yeah.
And so we would be drafting a difficult memorandum, and there would always be the Turkish-Greek footnote where the Turks and the Greeks would agree to disagree. But there would, many times, there would be, you know, we would be at an impasse. And the British member of the group would say, well, let me go away over the weekend and try a new draft. And Monday morning would come in, and here would be this deathless prose on the table that captured everyone's desires perfectly. And everyone would applaud and sign the memo. And a week or two later, you would find that the UK position was subtly but rather disproportionately advanced by that draft, too. So it was using the mother tongue as a strategic tool.
That's really interesting.
What do you think explains that high level of cooperation? Is it maybe the language or the history or why?
Yeah,
do you think the same level of cooperation could have happened with a different country?
Well, you know, NATO, in my experience of NATO, which I found inspiring, we had close relationships with many NATO allies. But it was different with the British. And I think it's simply, its common language has a lot to do with it. But everybody that did much with NATO, the Germans and the Danes and the Italians and the Turks, spoke fine English. So the fact that it wasn't their birth language didn't seem to make much difference. Having said that, however, I think the shared language, but you know the old joke that the British and the Americans are two nations separated by a common language. So it wasn't as if it was sort of really speaking quite the same language. There are always nuances that are misunderstood.
But
it's the history. I mean, it's the history. And coming out, I think up until, and maybe still going on, but certainly in the 70s, when I first began to engage in the interchanges when I was at Livermore, the memory of World War II was still there, really influenced a lot, I think. The generation that was, I mean, I was a generation later, but the more senior people in both the UK and the US programs in the 70s had been adults during World War II. Some of them had been engaged in the Manhattan Project, and they remembered the good relations. It wasn't always sweetness and light. There were disagreements, but the way the disagreements worked out always ended up strengthening the relationship. And that memory from World War II was still there.
Do you remember any particular disagreements?
No, I really don't.
You said something earlier that I thought was fascinating about how they have maybe a different or a more insightful approach to some of these nuclear issues. And maybe it's just that it was different, so it's more insightful for you because you wasn't thinking about it. I mean, do you think that there was or could you, I guess, clarify that, or how would you characterize the different way of thinking that those scientists had, if there was one, and maybe what explains that?
In the U.S., let's see, let me start this over again. We had the biggest computers and the biggest computer codes, and there was to some extent a tendency to run a problem with the code and sort of believe the answer. Now, I'm not doing justice to the really mature designers that knew the codes were wrong, but for us, the way it worked was you put the physics in the codes, and then the designer ran the codes, and there was kind of a slight barrier represented by the codes between the designer's physical intuition and the real science that bore on the behavior of the weapon. Because the codes weren't nearly as capable in the UK, I think the design people had to think more as physicists than as designers.
Is that what you were dealing with mostly?
Yeah.
Designers.
Well, designers, yes. And it's interesting that since the U.S. stopped testing in the early 90s, we are seeing a transition where our designers now are thinking more like physicists because they have to understand the physics better. That's been a difficult transition for us. I think it was sort of more seamlessly there in the UK than it was for us until just recent years. That transition is still going on at our labs. And I think it was, and you know, we always, I remember, we all thought some about how do the Soviets approach weapon design. And they were famous for coming up with very ingenious what's called closed form solutions to the equations of physics that we would have to solve in a big computer in approximate form. And it was always a kind of a nervous surmise that maybe the Soviet scientists, designers, thought more like physicists. And we would look at the British and say, you know, they're better than they ought to be because of the tools they have. And maybe the Soviets are better than they ought to be with tools that may not be as good as ours too. It was kind of an interesting, I mean, it was entirely speculative, but it always made me a little nervous.
Almost running out of time, but I want to ask a few questions. You've already addressed this implicitly, but about the science policy interface in this context. How would you characterize the interface between the policy community and the scientific community in the context of these bilateral cooperation agreements, sort of beyond what you've already mentioned about the technical community pushing it and it being responded by the policy community?
My attitude about nuclear weapons, and I think it's one that is probably not unique to scientists, but it is enhanced a little bit by my scientific point of view, is that nuclear weapons are too important to be left to governments. And so I always felt, and I think many people at our labs, felt that in some sense, as private citizens who happened to be inside working on nuclear weapons, we had a somewhat independent responsibility for making sure things that went well with regard to nuclear weapons. I think the UK scientists felt very much the same way. I think that, in my view, actually, to digress on a point, it was to protect that mindset that the relationship with the University of California as the, well, I mean, the formal relationship was as a contractor, but the for the U.S. nuclear weapons labs, but the informal relationship was not really a contractual relationship. It was sort of that the University of California sort of was at the interface between the labs and the government to make sure that everything that a democracy ought to demand about that interface went well. The UK labs didn't have that kind of an interface, but I think that the point of view that the scientists at the UK labs had was very much the same as ours. Ours was fostered by the, for many years, in recent decades, it was not much a part of the UC role, University of California role, but at the beginning it was. And the UK folks had much the same attitude that was sort of protected for us by the UC relationship.
As I understand it, the technical community was wholly in support of cooperation. There were no elements of the community that felt like they had to cooperate.
No, you're exactly right. Yeah, yeah. It was an entirely willing thing on both sides.
Okay. Did you witness the cooperation sort of enabled by the treaty materialize in the lab in the way that it was envisaged on paper?
Yeah, I would say so. Yeah. But as your previous question implied, it worked out on paper not because the paper shaped the relationship, but because the relationship probably shaped the paper.
Right.
What were the challenges that were faced in the lab in cooperating bilaterally that policymakers either glossed over or challenges that maybe wouldn't have warranted political attention?
We were always conscious of the boundaries in the scope that we had to not go beyond in the interchanges. And I think we always sort of bent over backwards to build in a little margin between what the formal boundary was and the operational boundary, in the sense of being conservative and staying a ways away from the boundaries on the scope. And that would often, I'm kind of making this up, but the flavor of it would be a discussion would be going gangbusters, and then all of a sudden somebody on the U.S. side or maybe on the U.K. side would say, well, now, wait a minute, I was about to say, but I probably shouldn't. And that would happen from time to time, and everybody would chuckle a little bit, and then we'd go off and talk about something else. But it was there. It was there.
Yeah, I'd just like to know a little bit more about those boundaries. Did that materially impact your relationship with those people, either personally or professionally, in a way that it didn't? I mean, I imagine that those boundaries exist as well, even domestically amongst the United States scientists that you're working with. But did you feel, I mean, was it real? Did you feel a different, just kind of slightly different way that you can approach those scientists versus the United States?
When you'd go home at night, there was a much firmer boundary between about what you could talk about with your wife than there was with what you could talk about with your UK counterpart who happened to be visiting the lab. When you're in a business that where high levels of security are involved, you get used to that sort of thing.
I'm not sure if they're going to shut off the recorder. It's one.
Well, there's a whole list of kind of other questions that they wanted us to ask, just generically.
Well, go ahead and
ask
them and see if...
See if it's recording. About the MDA, I'm much, much gladder that we got the questions about kind of the personal stuff, which is much more interesting to me. But just your personal opinions about about cooperation, prospects for, increased mutual interdependence, or what you think it will look like in 50 years. Any of your personal thoughts?
Well, I value it tremendously. I personally, maybe it's because I kind of grew up during World War II and the Cold War, but a lot of my deep mindset revolves around the value of democracy and sort of the underlying ways of looking at the world that allow democracy to work. And I think we got a lot of those from Britain. And I suspect that we will continue to have that sort of thing. I always found not only the UK relationship, but NATO itself, I think I used the same word earlier, inspiring. At particularly difficult junctions during the Cold War, I think a lot of us had the sense that the democracies and democracy were somewhat beleaguered. And it was always inspiring to see these democracies working out their sometimes rather substantial differences in a democratic way. And to me, the UK and British history really epitomizes those mindsets and those processes. So I think it'll be there for a long, long time. Right now, just to give you an example from the last year or two, the U.S. is in the midst of this kind of mini agony about what is the role of our nuclear weapons in the future and nuclear weapons in general. And we seem to be kind of paralyzed by our lack of consensus on that. I sometimes think that we're paralyzed because we do have consensus, but maybe we're also paralyzed because we don't. But over the last two or three years, the Brits have worked out this this position about the future of their deterrent, and they, and I believe Gordon Brown is committed to carrying on fundamentally the same line that Tony Blair did. They are going to have a nuclear deterrent for the foreseeable future. And that sort of, let's see, how can I characterize this? I mean, it seems to me that these kinds of discussions in the U.S. tend to be ideological and therefore sort of polarized. And in Britain, I think their history leads them to not work problems as much as we do as matters of principle, more as pragmatic things where finding a consensus is a pragmatic way to get to a British position. And they've done that in their recent decisions and policies about the future of their deterrent, and frankly, I think we could emulate that. I'm not sure it's in us to do it, but...
Can you comment any more about the relationship between the MDA and your work with NATO and nuclear sharing in NATO?
As I said at the beginning, I tended not to see a boundary between the things that I was working in NATO that involved the other allies and the MDA. The boundary was clearly there. But I remember talking with Ron Mason, my counterpart, British counterpart, at length about NATO nuclear weapons issues in general that were beyond, about the nature of deterrence and how and this tension between sort of operations with nuclear weapons in order to have the prospect of being able to operate that way help deter, and the tension between that and handling the weapon safely and securely. Now, that really was not, I mean, it was kind of, it was so much not a part of the MDA kind of interchanges that I suspect it was never even mentioned as a thing that was either inside or outside the scope. But Ron and I would talk about that a lot, and I think we both learned something. And I think he carried what he learned into the British Ministry of Defense, and I know I carried what I learned into the U.S. DOD.
You may have already said that, but were you saying that the your cooperation with U.K. counterparts was primarily on the safety security end of that spectrum, or did it cover?
No, it covered the whole. I mean, under the MDA, it covered not so much security, but certainly safety and weapon design itself. The NATO issue was almost not at all related to weapon design. It was how you operate in the field with nuclear weapons, both in peacetime and how you might operate in wartime. And so there was a, you know, there was really a distinction between those two spheres of interaction. But because the cooperation was so close under the MDA, it just seemed natural to use those personal relationships to explore this other more operational and deterrence-related sphere. We were about to deploy mobile missiles, you know, the Pershing 2 and the ground-launched cruise missile, and in order for those to operate survivably, they had to be out moving around in the countryside, at least in a crisis, and a little bit in training during peacetime. Now, the UK did not have any, UK nuclear weapons simply did not operate that way. But it was a problem that required good thinking. And Ron Mason, for instance, was a good thinker. And because we were so close, because of the MDA thing, we would talk about those kinds of things also.
So you think it's a fair statement that the personal relationship that you developed under the auspices of the MDA made NATO nuclear cooperation vis-a-vis deterrence more robust?
No doubt about it.
Awesome. What do you think the role of nuclear weapons and NATO will be over the next, how will it evolve over the next 50 years?
Wow. I wish I knew. I hope that nuclear weapons will become a less and less, an even less and less necessary part of NATO's security posture, because I hope that the world moves in a direction that allows that. If it doesn't, then I would say that nuclear weapons will continue to play a role in NATO, different in some ways than how it operated during the Cold War. But I mean, kind of one of my theories about nuclear weapons is that when the world gets into a situation where nuclear weapons are relevant at all, extended deterrence is maybe the central part of their relevance. And what we learned during about how to make extended deterrence work during with NATO during the Cold War ought to be a template for how we would make extended deterrence work in NATO or any place else if it is needed in the future. We're losing that memory.
This is kind of
You all ought to do a thing on that, by the way. I think I've suggested that to John Hamry before, but
this is partly because I'm personally interested, but you're hoping that they become less necessary because you hope the world will move in that direction. What would a world that needed less nuclear, how would it be substantially different than the world we live in now, given that, you know, they were initially placed there to deter the Soviet Union, which is no longer, you know, explicit adversary?
Nuclear weapons are about relationships between great powers. And if those relationships are broken or, you know, frayed, then nuclear weapons will be more relevant. I guess I would hope that the future would see a world in which great powers, and Russia is still on its way to becoming maybe not the greatest, but still a major player, but China too. I would hope to see a world where relationships among the great powers would be basically harmonious, whether it will or not. I think we're on a tipping point. Tipping point is a little too sharp, but the next 10 or 20 years, I think, is going to largely determine whether great power relationships are harmonious during the last part of the 21st century or not.
This, again, is divergent a little bit, but, given that we're obviously not in the Cold War anymore, what do you see as the strategic function of our tactical nuclear weapons in Europe?
I think a lot of it has to do with kind of looking to the future and saying we might need to have them there at some time in the future if we, what should I say? I think the only reason we need them now is because we might need them in the future, and it would be difficult to get them deployed in Europe again if we took them out.
Yes.
I don't know how far, you know, there's this kind of relationship between the future and the present that, you have to think about. And I don't know how far, let's see, how can I articulate this? I used to be able to say this better than I will right now, but if there were a harmonious great power relationship today, hypothetically, you'd have to ask yourself, is that harmony durable or not? And what's the time constant? What's the time under which it might, over which it might change from harmonious to inharmonious to discordant? And and if you believe that that time is 50 years, another way of saying that time is how long would you have of strategic warning? And if you think you'd have 50 years of strategic warning, then you could probably, you know, do almost anything. You could put back almost anything or invent almost any posture you needed in 50 years. If you think you're only going to have 10 years of strategic warning, you might not want to give up what you have now because you might not be able to get it back in 10 years. And frankly, thinking about how long you would have goes to the heart of this age-old question of whether there is such a thing as a national character and how long does it take to change. It looks to me as if the Germans and the Japanese fundamentally changed their national character because they were so thoroughly defeated in World War II. I don't know how other nations' national character changes. And those are unanswerable questions. Yeah.
In the early years of both the U.S. and the U.K. program, the kind of best scientists and the best engineers were recruited into the atomic field, and I think it wasn't that uncommon for them to have senior leadership roles by their mid-30s. That today the both countries are kind of struggling to maintain and recruit talent, in part because of the lack of testing, maybe, or the sort of longevity and the infrequency of the nuclear projects. How do you think that we could revive the scientific community, either through policy initiatives or, you know, if whether you think testing or resumption of testing would be necessary for that?
You know, in some ways, the resumption of testing has actually, I mean, the cessation of U.S. testing has actually helped a little bit. I think because Vic Reese in DOE and George Miller at Livermore largely, before he became director, kind of invented science-based stockpile stewardship. The challenge of understanding how nuclear weapons, how the science works, and how the physical processes work in nuclear weapons more deeply, because you had to without testing, will have carried the excellence of the science at the labs and the excellence of the scientists at the labs through 20 years, from the mid-90s to the, I don't know what, another 5, 10, 15 years. After that, we will probably have explored the science as much as it would be useful to explore without doing some more nuclear tests to make sure we got it right, and we probably won't do that. And I'm a little worried that there's not going to be the draw for young scientists to come to the labs. Now, my strategy for dealing with that is to have the labs involved in national security technology issues that are important to the country and for which the which involve basic science, and for which the science and the technology is just a step removed from the science and technology that is specifically needed for nuclear weapons. The classic and a good example is NIF at Livermore, the National Ignition Facility, where much of the science involved in getting a fusion capsule to ignite when compressed by laser energy, laser power, much of the physics is the same. Not all of it, but much of the physics is the same as it is in nuclear weapons. So, and it's a real draw. I mean, having this big, wonderful experimental facility where you can go out and try to probe how those little implosions work, that's going to be a big draw for another 15 years at Livermore. Los Alamos is struggling to find kind of another, well, the word is signature facility or signature project or program, which will, for which the science will be as close to the heart of nuclear weapons science as NIF's science is, and as much of a draw for people to come in and continue to want to work at the labs and be potentially re-involvable in nuclear weapons if we should need them again. So I think one of the key policy issues in front of the country right now is how to involve the labs in a true national lab mode, not just a kind of a collection of little projects, but a real mission for the labs, in other national security things in which science is heavily required and the science is just a step or two removed from the science of nuclear weapons. I think there are some glimmers of possibility, but it's not clear to anybody exactly how to do that. But I think it's a crucially important thing, and it's a strategic thing for the nation to work through that problem. How that will be dealt with in the UK, I do not know. I think that, and in fact, as I said, I haven't been to AWE in many, a long, long time. The French have led the world in maybe not led the world, but they've had a correspondingly exciting program in inertial confinement fusion, which is another name for the what goes on in the NIF thing. And the UK have a program in it. AWE has some work going on. But I'm not sure that it will play the same role in the UK as it will have to play here. So I don't know exactly how they'll work that problem.
Speaking of France, would you like to comment on the trilateral U.S., UK, French nuclear cooperation relationship, how that impacts the MDA?
You know, it was... I think it was turned trilateral after I left the Pentagon, but I also had something to do with the bilateral U.S.-French relationship in the something of the same role as I did for the bilateral U.S.-UK relationship. And one of the things I wanted to do and tried to get started, and I think did get started, was turning it trilateral. I truly have not kept up with... how sort of intimately and fully trilateral it is. At the time we were talking about getting it started, both my UK colleagues and my French colleagues kind of built conceptual models for how we would put sort of the right barriers, in the sense that the MDA, the UK relationship, defines a scope for the what can be talked about. If that's a barrier, we talked about the nature of the barriers and how those barriers might work in a trilateral relationship. And I guess that all got worked out after I left. But I'm not very familiar with the details of how it's gone. I think it's gone pretty well. I don't want to imply that it hasn't gone well, but I'm just not familiar with the ways in which it has gone pretty well.
Okay. I think, try to wrap it up. Lastly, what is your advice for the next generation of nuclear policymakers and scientists and technicians and that involve themselves in this relationship for furthering the relationship? What is your advice for anyone that plans on cooperating with a UK counterpart in this field?
I wish there were a robust next generation of nuclear policymakers. I look at Pony as as the place where they're going to come from. But I think we're going to go through kind of a half a generation gap between the time when people who have sort of been brought into the policy world through PONY will become senior enough to really be policymakers. And I'm a little worried about that gap. The gap before the PONY generation is eligible. And us graying silverbacks, as John Henry calls us. On the scientific side, I think that I'm not worried so much about a gap in the same time frame, you know, sort of between 2010 and 2020, maybe, because I think that the science-based stockpile stewardship, at least at the two physics labs, Livermore and Los Alamos, is going to be bridged by the good people who came in to do the science of understanding nuclear weapons without testing. So it's going to be a kind of a generation later, you know, 2020 and after, when I think I will begin to worry about the science side of it. A sort of a neat thing that's happening is there is beginning to be, scientific review committees outside the labs are playing a bigger and bigger role. When I started at Livermore, you hardly ever saw anybody out in the academic community or anywhere else interacting with the labs. There were just a handful of people at universities. Today, you know, there are lots of the JASONs, lots of kind of cooperative relationships between the labs and academic physics departments. And that's something that's new. And I could imagine that in some sense the sort of boundary within which you think of nuclear weapons science existing, which used to be almost coextensive with the boundaries of the labs, is going to extend further out into the academic community. And I think that's going to be good. It's going to mean some cultural transition, which is, I think, beginning to be worked, but that's going to be good. So that's on the plus side.
And so the gap that you're concerned about, you said between 2010 and 2020, the scientific gap you're not as concerned about because people had experience with nuclear weapons without testing. Is that the policy gap, though, that 20?
So I'm seeing a policy gap kind of between 2010 and 2020. I'm not seeing a science gap between 2010 and 2020, but I'm seeing the possibility that one will develop after about 2020.
Well, I think we're probably finished about 1:30, but I hope they were recording that last part of it. It was great.
Good. Okay.
It's been fascinating,
good.
At least.
Good. Yeah. Fun for me to try to remember some of it. You will probably find that I've got some facts wrong. I'm finding that more and more.
If there's anything that I feel maybe should be double checked, I'll do, you know, open source.
I would encourage you really to check
yeah,
strongly.
And then I'll send it to you, and then you can, and whether these things are, you know, capital P true, you know, in the abstract, I don't think.
Yeah. Yeah.
I think what's most fascinating is just kind of the level of kind of intimate cooperation you had in details,
yeah.
That it is.
There's another thing I should say about this policy-science relationship, and that is that the senior people at the labs, the directors, are not nearly as much involved in what I will call national level issues. I'm not sure I want to call them policy issues, but sort of national level issues about nuclear weapons and science and technology as they once were. And that is coming around about for at least two reasons. One of them is that the view of the labs is increasingly as just another contractor. And the other one is that the lab managements are overwhelmed, inundated, drowning in red tape and administrative work. And a lab director who could spend his time thinking about how nuclear weapons played on the international scene 30 years ago can't do that now. The lab directors much less frequently testify before Congress than they used to, and it's partly because they're not trusted as much, because they're suspected of the same kind of conflicts of interest that contractors have, and it's partly because they're unable to do their homework because they're busy doing paperwork all the time. And I think that is an absolutely deplorable trend.